Thank you for coming tonight. I'm sure if you saw my picture or saw the title of this book, you're like, what is this? The hardest piece is to ask us to walk into a story that we know extremely well, and perhaps to see something that's perhaps startlingly fresh. I'm reminded of Gene Houston, the American psychologist who was brought in to train the NASA astronauts that were going to land on the moon. And what she had to do is she had to teach them not to look in the way that they were accustomed to looking, because once they landed on the moon, those first astronauts that did, if they just came with their understanding of eyesight on Earth, they would perhaps miss what was totally new. So I'm going to ask, in some ways tonight, for you to suspend judgment, although please don't suspend critical function, to take a journey into these texts that we know perhaps too well, and to see something which may be very, Pip says, luminous and fresh. I hope that will be true. I am first generation of Lebanese parents who came to the States 100 years ago, carried in the arms of their parents. So I came along very late in my parents' life, but I grew up in a Lebanese village in the heart of the industrial South. And I had this rare moment to see the old ways while I made the cross, the bridge to Western industrial understanding. But if there is one piece that I may bring to looking at these texts of the gospel, it is an understanding of the Semitic mind. And I would remind all of us, as I constantly remind myself, that Semitic means the village people of Israel, Jordan, and Lebanon. We're all Semites, sadly divided by religion, but it's one culture. And my mother and father's family go back in one village way up in the mountains of Lebanon, and we have the family tree that goes back more than 900 years. And it's a Christian village. And I assume that the way that they understood the text and the way that they taught me to see the text is pretty much an unbroken lineage over all those centuries, and maybe even back to the 4th century when Christianity came into Lebanon. One of the keys of that is that these texts are poetry. And not only that they're poetry, but they are only to be sung, not said. Now, remember that we've come from a Jewish tradition, our Jewish mother, where if a text is sacred, you chant it. You do not say it. And so the way that I learned the gospel text was sitting on my grandmother's knee, my Sitho's knee, as she chanted the text to me. And what I heard in her heartbeat is the rhythm of something underneath the words. And that rhythm, that beautiful melody line underneath the words, touched my heart, informed me in a way. And so that much later, when I went to college and then went to seminary and did my theological work, I was totally enamored of Western thought and understanding. But what I did not find there for me was the numinous heart that I heard underneath my grandmother's chanting. A way of hearing the text that immediately brought me almost to tears. So I went in search through my life for something that I'm calling, I want a gospel text that has that beautiful poetic resonance along with critical mind. I don't want a church to tell me to take these texts without thinking them through, nor do I want someone to ask me to have the text without it totally inflaming my heart. So I started a long journey to find a new way for myself into the text. And basically what I'm doing as I go around the world now is I'm inviting people to consider the text in a new way. And to consider the text in a new way, let's go back and talk about what happened in the first century. In the presence of Jesus the Christ, there was a change in human consciousness in the first century. A change in human consciousness, which actually 2,000 years later, I think now we're ready to take the next step beyond what happened 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, across the planet, every religious tradition on the planet that we have record of 2,000 years ago was a tribal tradition. Now, what do I mean by that? Your God was your family's God. It was the God of your DNA. There was not some consciousness about the one God of all that would call us to be a family together. Judaism had had the beautiful teaching about the one God of all, but Judaism at that point in its history had not gone the next step to say that we could be family together. Their way of understanding the one God was separate but equal. Enter Jesus the Christ in the first half of the first century, and we have a stunning new step in human consciousness that's now going to say to the followers of Diana and Ishtar, as well as to the Jewish believers in Yahweh, that we all come from one source, and that that one source calls us to be human family together, gathered around one table. Now, that is a huge step in human consciousness when, to this point, there's no sense of an us. My grandparents, that I greatly emulate, probably some of the wisest people I will ever know in my life, and yet when I talk to my Sitho, my grandmother, she would say, we would look across the canyon in Lebanon at this village up on the opposite crags. We didn't know those people. We didn't know what God they worshipped. We didn't know where they came from. And this is a village maybe 10 kilometers away from our village. There was no sense of a Lebanon or Assyria, or anything else in the Middle East. It was village by village by village, bonded by, I know the bloodline. I have the bloodline. We have it written down in our family, our bloodline going back 900 years. So that's just 100 years ago. And Christianity was born at a moment where Jesus the Christ brought us a change in human consciousness. And Christianity at some times has reached for that, and at other times it's fallen away from that. But to birth the first form of a religion that will be pan-tribal, how the heck do you do that? Knowing the presence of Jesus the Christ is the first step in that, but knowing Jesus as my internal experience of God doesn't prepare me to actually live with people that I'm just coming to realize are also humans. Because basically in the tribal world, when I look at you and you're not from my bloodline, I don't know you. I don't even know if you're human. I don't know what God you worship. Now, to say that Christianity is going to invite all of us to the table together? Wow. So that's the first piece, is to realize that this message of Jesus the Christ, this message of love, this message of mercy, was actually a very practical explosion in human consciousness. I want to say today we're moving even a step beyond pan-tribalism, because now we're beginning to wrestle with a cosmos which is one. We're beginning to wrestle with the fact that mineral and plant and animal and stardust is not inanimate matter, but actually dynamic and has a level of consciousness in it. All right. So one piece of what I'm describing is that the gospel of the first century was something not just about a personal Jesus, but it was something about a new understanding of human consciousness that was going to ask me to look out at other people and say, they're a brother and a sister. The second thing is this long quote up here, and I'll read this and then we'll move on from this. It's a piece that I learned in theology back in 1978 by an American theologian named John Shea. I've never forgotten this quote. In those days, this quote actually was the front cover of the book. Can you imagine a book today that doesn't have a picture on it but has this quote? He wrote, "When we reach our limits, when our ordered worlds collapse, when we cannot enact our moral ideals, when we're disenchanted, we often enter into the awareness of mystery. We are inescapably related to this mystery, which is immanent and transcendent, which issues invitations we must respond to, which is ambiguous about its intentions, which is real and important beyond all else. Our dwelling within mystery is both menacing and promising, a relationship of exceeding darkness and undeserved light. In this situation, with this awareness, we do a distinctively human thing. We gather together and tell stories of God to calm our terror and hold our hope on high." Here's one of my other perspectives about these four texts that we call Matthew, Mark, and you're going to hear this sequence tonight, Matthew, Mark, John, Luke, that each one of these texts came at a moment of dilemma in a Christian community already baptized. That community was wrestling because they had reached their limits and their ordered world has collapsed. And they were wrestling to know, I already believe in Jesus. How do I live in this moment that no one prepared me for? There's a beautiful book written about the Jewish days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur by Rabbi Alan Liu of San Francisco. And the horrible title, "This is really happening to you, and you're totally unprepared." Each one, my view is, each one of these communities for which a gospel text was composed was exactly in that dilemma. This is really happening to us, and we are totally unprepared. So, we're going to look at the fundament. There are certain principles that come together in the creation of a gospel text. And one of these principles, I think, is quite familiar to us. I think the other one is not. The first is that each one of these texts is written to a particular community which has already received a historical base to Jesus, what I'm calling the Peter principle, where there's a historical and original eyewitness. But that's not all of the text. This is the principle, in my mind, that has been far underplayed in the last 100 years of scholarship, the Paul principle. Paul never saw Jesus. And yet, Paul was the great evangelizer of the first century. Why? Because Paul had an internal living experience of Jesus the Christ. And Paul was not saddled by the limitation of having seen Jesus. This is actually where I think my psychology is of value here. Because our scholars have been leaning on the Peter principle way, 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 way too much. It's like, as a tradition, we've been standing on one leg for about 200 years. In psychology, we actually know in organizational development that the first ones around a founder are very poor teachers. Why? Because they confuse the message and the personality. Because they don't know how to tease out the difference between what they saw with their outer eyes and what inner meaning it may have. And precisely because the people around the founder are very, very poor at generalizing out to new situations and new cultural moments other than what the founder did. So that first generation I'm calling the Peter Principle. An organization is always going to depend on what happens in its third and fourth generation, how it generalizes out to an audience more than what the founder taught. And that's the Paul principle. Paul, who had an internal experience of Jesus, and he says he did not go up to Jerusalem to hear all of the original words. He didn't go up to hear and to get the historical record. Hear that. Paul did not go get any of that information that we've been taught for the last 100 years to think is absolutely core. Paul had the living personal experience of Jesus the Christ, in which he says, I too am my witness. And Paul goes out and sets the first century on its ear. Why? Because Peter, James, John, all the ones who are around Jesus, when I go out and I talk about this person that I saw, this person I walked with, this person that I lived with, well, of course, you saw it. What's that got to do with me? You saw it with your outer eyes. Not Paul. Paul is that one who puts the fact that we are not a tradition of history. We are a tradition about a reality that happened at a moment in time, but the reality is not about that moment. That reality is not about 32 years or 35 years in Israel. Paul gets the better message. What happened in that one moment in time is the truth of every moment in time. And so, therefore, the historical record of Jesus is not going to be verifiable in Paul's eyes by archaeology or word study alone. They're going to be verifiable by the living experience in this moment in you. This is how the presence of Jesus works in you. This is how the presence of Jesus works in me. Paul's message is Eckhart Tolle's message. It's the power of now. Not a sacred newspaper of what Jesus did then, but now. And Paul's message of now and the living presence of now and the dynamism of now is what sets the first century on fire with this message about how we can transform our living to be a new form of the human family. Now, we need the Peter record, the historical witness, and we need the Paul record. So a gospel text is, now that we can move from standing on one foot to two, which will always be the more flexible stance, here's how I understand a gospel text. A gospel text is the marriage, the embrace between the Peter principle and the Paul principle, brought to bear in a human dilemma lived by a particular community in the first century. A community that is, oh my God, this is happening and we're totally unprepared. What does the risen Christ tell us about this moment? Well, we have the historical record, but not told for history's sake. We have the historical record brought forward to the present moment. In a moment, we're going to open up each of these texts, Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke, as the spiritual practice of a particular Christian community that was wrestling with a question that the historical Jesus didn't answer. And because of Paul, Paul is the preacher who knows how to open up the historical how to open up the historical record, but say it in the now. And say it in a way that each community needs to hear it in the second half of the first century. So this is going to reverse 100 years of our scholars saying we've got to cut back the discrepancies to get back to the core of a historical Jesus. I mean, the discrepancies are our glory. The discrepancies are Paul. The discrepancies are, here's the historical record opened up in the living dynamism of a community wrestling with a spiritual question. And what are those spiritual questions? Matthew's question is, how do I face a moment of tremendous change? Mark's question is, how do I move through a time of enormous trial and ordeal? John's community's question is, how do we pull up another chair at the table? And another one, and another one, and another one. Luke's question is, how do I mature in service? And now, if we will look at the texts, bringing the historical record forward to the community's dilemma, we'll understand how each text is a complete and perfect teaching of the risen Christ to a particular spiritual practice. So in this way, what we have is Peter plus Paul plus Rome. And the reason that I put plus Rome there is because this type of a gospel text is birthed in Rome. And it makes all the sense why this new form of sacred literature, and we don't have an example of this form of sacred literature before it appears in Rome. The Greeks don't write their sacred literature this way. Jewish people don't write their sacred literature this way. Rome doesn't write its sacred literature this way. In fact, very few traditions in history have ever written their sacred literature in the way these four texts are. What do they do? Well, one of the most important courses I took in my doctorate in clinical psychology was a course in creativity. And these four texts match some of the world's greatest creativity. And creativity is usually born at a moment of pain, confusion, anxiety. What happens in Rome in the summer of 64 is exactly the creative soil that's going to bring forth a creative response. Nero, you know, Rome burns. The great city for 7 days burns. Nero's got to have a scapegoat. Who's he going to turn to? Same group he's always turned to. The Jews. Except that this time it's not just the Jews, it's the Jewish Christians. And he fingers us for the burning of Rome, and he sends his soldiers into the Jewish quarter, and they're knocking on doors. Are you a believer in the Christ? If you say yes, you and your family are going to be immediately arrested. Your children, your grandchildren, taken to the floor of the Circus Maximus, staked to that floor, splattered with blood, and fed to starving dogs. Now, in the middle of, here's a dilemma that we could never have been prepared for. Rome has the right soil of tragedy for a new step in human consciousness. What does Rome also have? Rome has the teaching of Peter. And what also does Rome have? The teaching of Paul. One of the things that we have not given enough credence to is that each of these four texts are communities that had the teaching of Paul along with the teaching of an original eyewitness. So what's going to happen when this text of Mark is composed for this Jewish Christian community that is facing execution, genocide? The text is going to be, I'm going to tell you the story of Jesus the Christ in your life right now. It's going to bring the historical record forward, but it's going to be in the power of now. Why is the text of Mark going to open with a meditation on John the Baptist out in the wilderness? because the Jewish Christians in Rome know they're in that wilderness. They know that they're facing a like fate, that they're going to die for some other figure's folly, and that they're going to have to move through the valley of death by the power of the resurrection. If they're going to be, if they're going to have an even heart that's going to go to that door and answer the Roman soldier's question, are you a believer in the Christ? And you and your whole family is about to be executed. How do you prepare yourself for that moment? And I want to suggest to you that the oral composition of this text that we call Mark, from the first word to the last word of this text, is the preaching of the risen Christ. No resurrection at the end. In fact, there's not even a resurrection scene in this text of Mark written to a people facing genocide, because the entire text is the grace of the teaching of the resurrection, how you move through the valley of death. Just for a moment, consider a people in genocide not being given a story of a sighting of the risen Jesus. But because we've been standing on one foot, the Peter principle, for too long, we have forgotten the Paul principle, that these texts are the resurrection from the first line to the last line. And they are the spiritual practice of those who are baptized, who will see resurrection in their wrestling with death. That's the mark. So that it is in Rome that the ingredients that are going to be called a gospel text come together. The presence of a historical witness, Peter. The presence of Paul, who is a present moment now eyewitness, Paul, and a community in dilemma. Now, there's something else that Paul has done. And it's this power of now that Paul is bringing to us. Paul is the one who has got to translate from Aramaic into Greek and bring it out into the Greek world. Well, I know a little bit about Aramaic because growing up as a Lebanese Catholic, Aramaic was my liturgical language. It was the language I had. Other Catholics are learning Latin. I'm learning Aramaic because that was our worship language on Sunday. Aramaic has very few words in it, less than 2,000. Aramaic is a language which has very little sense of tense. It has a little bit of a past tense, but Aramaic is a language about a dynamic now. In Aramaic, the word is Messiah. Now, in English, with variation, you're going to say Messiah. But in Aramaic, the way that we would say that is Messiah. And the last expression of the word is just simply the outbreath. Messiah is everything that comes out of God. It's the meaning of the word in Aramaic. It's literally God expels God's very self out. And now we can understand why some are saying today that the cosmos is the first outbreath of God, and Jesus the Christ is the second outbreath of God, and that those two, the cosmos and Jesus the Christ, must mutually affirm each other because they are the same fullness of the outbreath. But Paul is going to take this sense of a dynamic outbreath of God and try to translate it into a Greek word. The word that he's going to choose is Christos. At least we say Christ, but at least when you say it in Greek, Christos, you have the expulsion of breath, which is so critically important in this understanding of a dynamic present moment God. God is a dynamic breathing reality right now. Each one of us is the living cells of God's breath right now. The cosmos is the dynamic moving cells, visible cells of God's breath right now. So, when Paul uses the term Christos, then he's got to start teaching the Jewish people and the Greek people that the Christos, the Messiah, has always been. The Messiah doesn't start with Jesus. Jesus is the fullness when the veil over our eyes may fall away, but the Christos, the breath, the one source of all, has always been since before the first moment of time. Jesus being born is simply the full manifestation, teaching us wider awareness, ever wider awareness. So it is precisely Paul's constant stress on the now, the dynamic now, which is the corrective I think we need today to the historical Jesus. The historical Jesus can, and most of my work is built upon the work of the historical Jesus, but not for history's sake. It is for present moment spiritual practice sake. Because the record of the historical Jesus helps me understand more deeply the presence of the resurrection in Rome in the midst of death. It helps me understand the presence of the resurrection in Antioch because they were facing an apocalyptic moment of change that nobody was prepared for. And it helps me understand what was going on in Ephesus when Ephesus was being challenged to bring another chair to the table and another chair and another chair and another chair and another chair and another chair. And it helps me understand what's going on to the community that Luke writes when we're excited beyond excited because we've got this wider revelation of God. We've got this new form of the human family. We want everybody to come along with this new world order that we can see. But what happens when we take this message of love and wider mercy out is we get executed. We get made illegals by the emperor. We don't have upward mobility. With this great message of justice and harmony, we have poorer homes, worse schools, less medical care, and on and on and on. And the text of Luke is going to be a text that invites us to accept the injustice of the world and to face it with love. Because as the text of Luke tells us, the more sure way to transform culture will be to change a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart. So I've jumped ahead a bit, but what we have here in a gospel text, in this new lens, takes what I hope is the best of what we have known for the last 100 years, but places it in a new configuration, which brings the text away from just 35 years of the first century and brings it home to the dynamic struggles of the community of the baptized. And then what is so compelling about these texts is these four texts become the questions of everybody on earth. Not just Christians. Everyone on earth wrestles with the four great questions. How do you face change? How do you move through ordeal? How do you receive joy and know love? And how does receiving joy and knowing love put us on the road of wider service? And it is precisely because these texts that we call Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke answer something very deep in the human heart that their wisdom has inspired us for 2,000 years and I believe will inspire us for 2,000 more years because they have in them the power of now. A now that started in a moment of history, but not a now to confirm history, but a text that confirms the history as it lives today. So the verification of a gospel should never be archaeology, DNA, transcripts of what Jesus said. The verification of a gospel text is, try this text in your heart, and you will see that this is exactly how grace works. History can help us understand how to know the parameters of the text, how not to fly off the wheel. But in this wider lens, it'll be the power of the text in its present momentness that'll be its great verification. It's 8:15. Let's take a good 10 minutes to breathe. When we come back, perhaps to turn to someone near you, see what's stirring, some question and answer. I will come back and give you a thumbnail for each of the four texts, how and why the church could so clearly, 300 years later, know that it had the right four texts. You already know the answer. Because the power of now. Because when you pray these texts, they move the human heart in a very particular way. That's how you know 300 years later that this is the correct record of Jesus the Christ. I'm forever grateful and a little jealous of Eckhart Tolle, whose book took away the great truth of Christianity, which is always, 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 always the power of now. I'll just give you the thumbnail of the four texts. And there's a larger reason why they're in this sequence, then I'll just hint at that. The text of Matthew, we believe, is coming from the community of Antioch in the 70s. Antioch is the community of record. Once Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple has been annihilated, the Jewish priesthood has been ended by massacre. Antioch is the largest Jewish community outside of Jerusalem. It's not where the councils met to reorganize Judaism, but because of the numbers of Jewish people in Antioch, it became the community most in need of being one to Judaism. What happens when the temple comes down and the priesthood is massacred? Much of Judaism feels it's the apocalypse. They feel that Yahweh has ripped up the covenant with Abraham. And even we who are Jewish Christians are totally shaken by this moment because we were expecting Jesus to come back at the temple. And it's really only after this moment that we begin to develop the sense of a priesthood. Because up until this moment, our priesthood was the Jewish priesthood. The Jewish Christian community in Antioch is wrestling with an event that they could never have been prepared for. At this moment, they hear the call about an inner temple and a new form of priesthood. And in this moment, they now have to step beyond their mother tradition. And as they try to step beyond their mother tradition, their family, their friends, their neighbors, their fellow Jews are shaming and shunning them. How? I know this after 9/11 in the United States. How dare you think about moving forward? We've got to build the World Trade Tower higher and better and say to the world, you can never do this to us again. Much of Judaism at this moment, and especially in Antioch, is filled with retribution, filled with the desire to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the old temple, make it bigger and better. Christians now understand that they have a new dispensation, a new obligation, a new form of the human family and a new religion, which is going to be moving beyond the tribalism of our mother to a religion which does not have Jerusalem as its center. But now we begin to hear about the new Jerusalem. The power of now. And the text of Matthew is the text, how are you going to face change? And it has in the text the difficulties, the feeling and thinking styles in us. And this, again, I guess, is where my psychology may have a bit to play here, is because underneath the stories, I see the feeling and the thinking styles that stop us from growth. And one of the most powerful things that stop us from growth is when we get stuck in feelings that we've been betrayed. It's just really curious that Matthew's passion gathers together all the notes of betrayal. Are those notes from the historical Jesus? Certainly. But why does Matthew give them to this in such a condensed form? To cast aspersion on Judas? To cast aspersion on our mother faith? Hardly. Each one of these texts comes down to a powerful spiritual practice. Each one of the texts has a signature moment, and the signature moment in Matthew is the moment where we say the passion begins, when Judas arrives to arrest Jesus. It's only in Matthew that at the moment of the arrest that he is again named as the betrayer. And then it says, and the text greeted Judas with the word, friend, do what you have come to do. Now, it is by the power of the resurrection that each one of us might greet those betrayal moments, the betrayal moments inside, the betrayals of friends, spouse, government, the betrayals of family, the way that we recognize that we are the betrayer, with the words, friend, do what you have come to do. Friend, do the work so that we might have greater awareness. Do the work so that we might know more compassion. Do the work so that we might be a people of more liberation, etc., etc. Now, what I cannot do here is open up how the entire text of Matthew is a text that line by line, chapter by chapter, teaches us about the spiritual practice of receiving a moment of change that we're not prepared for. Economic downturn, health issues, difficulties in our marriage, difficulties in the family, whatever it is, those moments usually come to us by surprise. And in those moments, we begin to have the same feelings and thinking styles that throughout human history, why is this happening to me? The text of Matthew gives the answer, not about why it's happening, but that it can be the fertile ground of spiritual growth through the power of the resurrection. We've already talked about the text of Mark, composed as the revelation of the resurrection in the midst of great ordeal and trial. And when I'm talking to the Catholics, I'll actually use the word suffering. When I'm talking to the Presbyterians, I usually use the word trial and ordeal. But that in this text of Mark, line by line, chapter by chapter, we have the teaching of the risen Christ addressing us into how we accept and move through ordeal, how we can use ordeal for the spiritual lessons that we need without wallowing in it. There's not a moment in Mark about wallowing in one more element of trial than what we need for our growth. But there is a way through Mark that we face into trial and use it. We come to the text of John. John, we believe, coming either out of Ephesus or Alexandria. The two cities are quite similar late in the first century. They are cities with a very lively women's community, and they are cities that are, the Christian community here is far more Greek Gentile than Jewish. Both of these cities have heard the message of the Christ gathering this new element of the human family together. I tend to think that John is more coming out of Ephesus because Ephesus has been founded on the preaching of Paul. And it's the preaching of Paul about this new form of the human family. We also know that Ephesus is a community founded on that preaching, but from the letters of John, a community that is quite contentious, argumentative, that even in the face of this new vision of love and oneness, that what's happening is they're squabbling. All the old categories have reasserted themselves. I mean, John is sort of like a teen retreat, or a good retreat for any of us. At the end of the retreat, our hearts have melted. Our hearts are open. We're looking out at others as brothers and sisters. We have this song of love in our before our eyes, and it's just flowing out of us. Then we go back to everyday life. And that wonderful retreat moment meets Monday morning and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, and the dream begins to ebb away. And actually now the dream begins to feel like a lie in the face of everyday reality. John's text from first line to last line are a series of meditations about how you bring love in and make it your foundation. And also how Jesus and Nicodemus, the woman at the well, the man born blind, the raising of Lazarus, these are great spiritual texts about how we get caught in small categories and start closing our heart down rather than keeping our heart open. One example, Jesus and Nicodemus. This is Nicodemus at the end of the first century saying to the Christian community, you can't have this teaching about one God of all bloodlines. You know this line that Nicodemus uses about you can't put a person back in a mother's womb? This is just on the ground bloodline tribalism. Show me, Jesus, how you can take somebody who is not Jewish, put them in a Jewish mother's womb, give them Jewish blood so they can have the ability to know Yahweh. You can't do it, Jesus, because I know natural law. Natural law says, nowhere in human history have we ever had this God of all bloodlines. What are you talking about, Jesus? You're crazy. You're overturning everything that we've always believed. Our tradition for 2,000 years has known that marriage is only between a man and a woman. We have those same bloodline issues today, but they're just a little bit more sophisticated or subtle. We're still talking tribalism. Every time somebody invokes a natural law argument about God, it's time to go back and meditate on Jesus and Nicodemus. And Nicodemus can't understand that God might open up human awareness for something new right now. And so we revert back to, well, it's always been this way. I don't have to really think about that issue anymore. Nicodemus is the tragic figure in the Gospel of John because he's a good person. He had good teaching from his mother and father. He had good teaching in rabbi school. But he stopped somewhere in his growth. He forgot to go back and ask God in the present moment what God is doing with us now, not 5 years ago, or 15 years ago, or 25 years ago. This is exactly what's going on in Ephesus at the end of the first century. This community that was founded with a new sense of the human family, now the old patriarchies are reasserting themselves, the old hierarchies are reasserting themselves, and the text of John has got to be the meditations on the grace of God that keep us forever examining how the old temple slips in the back door when we think we're building the new. The last text of Luke, the dilemma for the community of Luke is Luke is being composed at this moment when Christianity and Judaism are now in a terrible mutual divorce, sad to say. The Pharisees, who are great people, have a really bad moment. They have a bad hair day. And unfortunately, their bad hair day gets locked into the Christian scriptures. The Pharisees are the people who hold Judaism together after the temple, and 150 years later, they birth the rabbinical movement, which is what has held Judaism to this moment. They move the people away from cultic temple worship to personal spiritual practice. But we're now early in the days after the temple and the priesthood, and the Pharisees are anxious. Who wouldn't be? They're anxious about their 2,000-year-old tradition. And one of the things that they're anxious about is that anybody, any Jew who believes that the Messiah has already come, if this idea really gets going, my 2,000-year-old tradition is about to end. And so the Pharisee, who have no authority to legislate because they're not a priest, they are out there advocating by persuasion that if somebody believes that the Messiah has already come, that they should be drummed out of the synagogue. Well, is there anything that hurts more than a fight in the family? And we've got a very ugly fight as Jewish and Christian now begin to formally separate. But that's only the first half of the story. Once Christians now have to stand before the emperor as a new faith, the emperor is quite concerned about us. And not just because we're a new faith. It's what we're doing. The emperor could not be concerned about a name like Jesus. The emperor had how many gods, goddesses, and tree spirits to contend with? All the emperor wanted to know is, are you going to keep the social order of the empire? And we weren't. Why? Because we were raising the status of women. That was not what the emperor wanted. Because we were speaking to slaves and saying, you have dignity. We were not advocating women's rights at this point. We were not advocating the abolition of slavery at this point, but we were on the way. Because Christians were saying in this new form of human family that those with wealth have responsibility for those who don't. And because we were saying every person in the Roman Empire is a brother and a sister. Well, the emperor quite liked division. Keep a people divided, you can keep them conquered. The 100-year peace of Augustus, I hope your stomach turns. It's the 100-year peace of George Bush, who so enslaves a nation to keep them an inch away from starvation, to keep his army at peace. This is no peace. This is the Roman Empire that is one of the most barbaric, totalitarian regimes ever to live on the face of this earth. Hitler studied Rome to learn how to torture. This is what Christianity is up against in the first century. And so the text of Luke, which is one of the world's great texts of nonviolent resistance, says, we'll change Rome, but we won't change it with the sword, and we actually won't change it at the ballot box. We'll change it by the conversion of a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, even in the face of our execution. A heart, a heart, a heart, a heart, a heart. So we've got in Luke and Acts of the Apostles all these beautiful texts of reconciliation and forgiveness. Because we are at this moment trying to reconcile ourselves with our Jewish mother who's cast us out. And because we are faced with an emperor and an empire who is making us face the sword. So the text of Luke and Acts of the Apostles is, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., who wrote these words out of the civil rights struggles of America in the mid part of the last century, and words that mean a great deal to me, because in 1958 I stood outside my grandmother's home after it had been set on fire by the KKK. Martin Luther King wrote, send your hooded perpetrators into our homes at the midnight hour. Send your hooded perpetrators into our neighborhoods at the midnight hour. Burn our homes, beat our children, and break our bones, and we will not hate you. We cannot in good conscience obey unjust laws. And we will win our freedom. But we will so appeal to your heart and to your conscience by our ability to suffer, that when we win our freedom, the victory will be twofold, for we will have won yours as well. It's a text of Luke, where we will take the world's injustice, we will take the world's bitterness, and we will not return eye for eye. We will struggle for human liberty and dignity for all people. And Christians did this at the point of execution for 225 years. Can you imagine the stamina to believe in something at the point of execution for 225 years? Refusing to raise the sword, knowing that the truth of the Spirit would win out if we stay true to spiritual practice. If we chose to take the lesser route of downward mobility, because it was the truer route to human liberation. So, the last piece of this, and then I'll stop and see what questions amongst you there may be. When the church in the fourth century says, or it's already said, there is but one gospel and it must have four accounts. Well, why this four stuff? Aren't we collecting together the true stories of Jesus? There's got to be more. I mean, what's so magical about four rather than the truth of Jesus? Because from the first century, from our Jewish mother, Judaism gave to us this metaphor that there were four paths of the journey to God. It's the metaphor of coming out of Egypt, wandering in the wilderness, crossing into the promised land, making the promised land your everyday reality. Christianity had put this idea of the four paths into the sequence for Sunday worship and the preparation for baptism and the four fundamental prayers of Christianity and the shape of the cross, which is to have four points to it, not three points that Jesus died on. Not the verification of history, but the presence of now. And so what the church was looking for and so rightly deemed was the text of Jesus in us. And so that text starts with the text of Matthew, how we face change. Because every new journey with God is a journey of facing a moment of growth and change. And that growth and change is going to lead to wilderness. A wilderness unto physical death, but really is probably more psychological and emotional death. That change and wilderness will lead us to a new epiphany, a wider joy, a deeper understanding, new awareness, John. And that then that change and that trial and that new awareness must find its completion in service, Luke. So what was the church giving us? The church was giving us far more than the record of the historical Jesus, although it's there. They were actually giving us the spiritual path to live Jesus in our lives today. Text of Matthew. Through the resurrection, how you face change. Text of Mark. Through the resurrection, how you endure trial and ordeal. John. Through the resurrection, how do you receive new vision? Luke. Through the resurrection, how do we mature in service? So, rather than defining the truths of our faith, they gave us the well for every generation to go and find the new truth in the new moment. The power of now. Realize this is a huge challenge to most of us who have been standing on the one foot of the historical Jesus for a long time. But I am suggesting that it's time for us to put our foot down and stand with more stability, because we have in the record of the gospel the way for us to discern new truth in each moment. That's far more important to us than the mind of Jesus 2,000 years ago. Let's take a few minutes. You may want to just sit quietly. You may wish to turn to someone perhaps a friend or a neighbor or a spouse that you came with tonight. And just, what are you hearing? What's stirring? What I love is nobody needs to believe any of this. I do love that. I don't come here because I'm on seminary faculty, or I come here with what I think is a wider lens on the text, and I'm asking is whether this makes sense and sings in your heart. About 5-6 minutes, we'll see if there are questions from us, but just for a moment, take some time with yourself or with another. Okay. If you need any more evidence that we Semites are a passionate people, here I am. And our passion is never about trying to win an argument, but when Semites speak passionately, it's about evoking your own passion. So I've spoken passionately for more than an hour. Questions, thoughts, responses. I said, no one needs to believe any of this. It can be a pile of you know what. But if it begins to make sense, I would ask maybe for you to consider some parts of it. Yes, sir.
Saying that for me, that the story of Nicodemus and Jesus has always been one of the most powerful stories in the gospel, because, and this is not an exclusive interpretation, it's just another interpretation, so absolutely, it's not an argument, it's a paralleling, if you like. But I've always seen it as a person who was sensing that his own tradition was too small, and he was looking for something to liberate himself from that, and sensing that Jesus was the one who had it. And that in Jesus, and being a little bit obscure, you know, and say, you know, you can't go back into the womb and all that sort of stuff. It's a load of God cot. But Jesus, you know, saying, you know, being born again is like being born of the Spirit. And that bit about the Spirit being like the wind, and you know not whence it comes or whence it goes, you know, is that very powerful openness to the mystery of going with a wind that carries us and not being anxious about where it's going to set us down. Right. And you know, whether it's in pastoral situations or facing life and death or new vocational opportunities or challenges to risk take and those sorts of things, I've always got a lot of power out of that story. Yeah.
Thank you. I would add just that as you open up the text of John through the lens of Ephesus, we need to be very careful whenever we come to that word world in John. A much better translation for us today is unawareness. John has already said that God's Spirit fills every cell of matter. So he's not talking about matter. But that line about God so loves our unawareness that God does not send the only begotten into our unawareness to condemn unawareness, but that we might have more freedom.
Thank you, Alexander, for everything that you shared. I find it, that process of from that previous graphic that you have of movement is just wonderful. But I've got a real soft spot for the Gospel of Thomas. If we had to have four, I'd think I'd like to do without John and have Thomas instead, because Thomas really did help people understand that it wasn't about that historic Jesus. I mean, Thomas is the one who can, I think, move us into the way, into the process, perhaps sometimes more than John, though John is obviously very burdened by what the church has done to that text in terms of exclusiveness and that emphasis on intellectual assent to doctrine rather than to the process of being and becoming. I can see that the emphasis on the four, on the quadratus, means a lot to people who are within the church, you know, that sense that the chanting you know, that there was real, that was the thing that would reveal the heart. But I'm also aware that many of us in the 21st century are open to all sorts of different sources from other faiths and from, you know, other sources of wisdom, like traditions like psychology and all sorts of things. So, yeah, is there a space to acknowledge the sacred speaking to us beyond the four?
There is nothing magical about four. What the gospel text is trying to get us to do is to return to that heartbeat. Gabriel Roth gives it to us in five. Therese gives it to us in seven. And on and on and on. What I think what this work is describing is first that there is this pattern. Throw out the number. There is this pattern about how the heartbeat of God moves across the cosmos. And what's important is for us to celebrate, know, and live the dance of the pattern, not fourness. What I'm trying to describe for the gospel text is how the gospel text opens up the pattern. For early Christians, it was the four number. Just in the last 6 weeks, I discovered Gabriel Roth's five rhythm dancing as a meditation in Auckland. She just breaks what I have. She breaks the fourth movement into two movements, giving us five. I don't care about it, but it is, there is a pattern to how this energy moves in us. Be with the pattern. Follow the pattern. Dance the pattern. One of the things that I said to Pip, I mean, I'm really excited about, and eventually someday it's going to happen, but a Christian-Buddhist dialogue where, because what I see, but I'm seeing it from the Christian side, I see a direct corollary between the text of Matthew and the first noble principle of Buddhism, which is impermanence. The second noble truth of Buddhism, which is the truth of suffering and Mark. The third noble truth of Buddhism, which is non-attachment, and how the text of John speaks about the fullness of the one. And finally, the fourth noble truth of Buddhism is the eightfold path of right relationship. Well, we have that truth in the text of Luke. So it's not that the gospel is a powerful lens, but what's important is the truth of this pattern. And how all of our faiths, I believe, are an expression of the pattern, whatever number, and by whatever text we're following to get there. Anything else? This is a lot for this evening. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the images of the four seasons, I guess, I don't know enough about previous cultures and that to know, have the seasons always been broken down into four?
There's some cultures that go beyond four.
Yeah.
I'm not aware that anybody has broken the year into less than four.
Mm. But I was just interested also in anything you had to say about the seasons.
I see it in the text. Judaism imagines autumn and sunset. That moment when the light begins to dim is always the beginning of the new journey. So autumn, sunset, winter, nighttime, dawn, early morning, spring, Luke, summer, and the full heat of day. Again, nothing magical about four, but I would say that there is a truth in us about that wheel. Ever ongoing, hopefully deepening and widening, And that we're never in one of these places at, I mean, our life is in all four at once. But we also can stand back and see the pattern. Yes, sir.
Thanks very much. I can't really think of a question at the moment, but my heart has been stirred, and I thank you for that. I will go back and reread each of those Gospels again with each of those themes, and I'm really looking forward to it. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I will say both, I mean, there is a book, yes, there is an audio course. The text speak in story, which the Semitic mind understands that it's not the story itself, it's the wrestling with the story and what that opens up underneath. So, the historical metaphors, understanding the historical metaphors, helps us more easily access the deeper wisdom. And that's where history is so critical and important. So I invite you to really go explore the text see if it opens up for you as something new and fresh. Anything else? Go on once, go on twice. So thank you very much for such an attentive and patient listening to this passionate Semite. Thank you.